His Twitter bio reads, journalist, storyteller, and lifelong reader, a Texan by birth and by choice, full stop. What an honor to welcome legendary television news anchor Dan Rather on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. He's been eyewitness to the events that shaped our nation, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War, Watergate. What do you want to ask the veteran journalist? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Dan Rather anchored the CBS Evening News for 24 years, taking over for Walter Cronkite in 1981. And his most recent book is called What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Dan Rather, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you this morning, Kate. I'm really appreciative of the time and the opportunity to be with you.
Well, you're with us all here in Wisconsin, and this will be really special. Can we start with COVID that is just ravaging every corner of our country? And it seems to have united us in the search for a vaccine, but it's really divided us over mask wearing and public health. What do you think are the sobering lessons our nation has learned in this pandemic?
Well, it's an old lesson that we seem to have to learn over and over again, and that is that in a society such as ours, with a government system such as ours, it's absolutely imperative that we work together, be united, if you will. And when we are divided, and when we're most divided, is when we are most vulnerable. And this has been the case during this terrible pandemic. Plus, I would have to note, which it's obvious but worth reminding ourselves, that we have been exceptionally poorly led during this pandemic. And I'm not referring only to the presidency of Donald Trump, but overall, in the main, there's certainly been some exceptions. We've been very poorly led. And so that leads to the conclusion that among the things that are very important is leadership is important. And when we go to the polls and vote, sometimes I think we lose sight of the fact of how important leadership can be. So we've been reminded that when something like the pandemic hits, you need strong leadership. We have not had it during this, and which is one reason that we're paying a heavy price and continuing to pay a heavy price. I noticed in the news section leading into this interview, Kate, that in Wisconsin, the figures are absolutely terrible on the virus, but this is true in most places around the country, and it does speak to we've really hurt ourselves by being so divided along political and ideological lines and because we've been so poorly led.
It makes you wonder, how did public health get so consumed by politics, get so intertwined with politics? Was it like this all along?
No, it has not been like this all along, particularly in matters of public health. You know, I'm old enough to remember that when polio was absolutely the scourge, and was every mother's nightmare, when polio was ravishing the country, the country was pretty united, in fact, very united in just, you know, saying, listen, we've got to find a cure. And when a cure was found, the country united behind it very quickly, to the point that polio, as we speak today, is certainly a terrible thing, but is no longer the threat that it once was. But that's just one example. Now, your question about how did public health get so intertwined with politics? Again, I come back to leadership. That leadership in certain quarters decided that they could keep the country well divided over such things as, listen, the scientists really don't know what they're talking about. It's been one of the most, I think, dangerous developments in our country in recent years, a kind of anti-science movement, that if the scientists say these are the three things you need to do to stem the tide of the virus, wear a mask, keep social distancing and wash your hands regularly, then it was deemed politically astute to say, well, the scientists don't know what they're talking about. But this anti-science movement goes much, much beyond simply what we've dealt with during this virus, as important as that and dangerous as that's been. It goes beyond to what kind of society we're going to be. One of the things I've tried to write about in the book, What Unites Us, is how important science has been and a belief in science and supporting science, how important all that has been through our history as a country. In the last 3 or 4 years, this anti-science movement, which has kind of manifested itself in its worst form during the pandemic, is really something we better start thinking about very seriously.
I'm going to reintroduce you. We're talking with Dan Rather. He anchored the CBS Evening News for more than 20 years, one of the best-known names and voices in broadcast journalism. You can join in. What would you like to ask Dan Rather about these times? What do you think about how divided politically and otherwise our country is? Do you think we can heal and mend the division? Join in at 800-642-1234. You have covered a lot of elections over the decades. Wisconsin certified its presidential election results this week after a partial recount here. What are the ramifications of President Trump not conceding, about lying about election fraud? What does that do to us as a nation?
Well, we're about to find out. It sometimes takes time. And as history unfolds going forward, we're going to see what the full ramifications of this may be. We do need to mark and recognize very clearly that this has never happened before in our history. No previous president of the United States has ever gone to such lengths to try to undercut the basic belief in the integrity of the election system. We've certainly had very close elections in the past. We've had highly contentious elections, and we've had people coming after the vote, questioning whether the vote was honest. But we've never had a sitting president deliberately set out to create distrust in the whole election system. Now, this time it failed. But what President Trump has done is lay out a roadmap for some future president. Let us hope and pray it doesn't happen. But he's laid out a map that somebody in the future could say, you know, President Trump, he didn't succeed, but he did lay the kind of seeds that we're going to do to overturn an election. We know from our history what happens in countries where this kind of thing is allowed to become normal. In President Trump's case of challenging the election to the extent that he's done, this is not only abnormal, it's unprecedented. In a lot of other countries, it's been the road to autocracy and eventually dictatorship. People don't like to hear that kind of talk because they say, well, you're overreacting. Now, to your question, you know, going forward, what are the ramifications of President Trump not conceding? Let us hope that this is a one-time only occurrence, what has happened today. Going forward, we'll find out whether it becomes what has been abnormal, unprecedented in our time, whether at some future time it could become the norm.
What would you say to the 70 million Americans who voted for President Trump?
I would say to them, first of all, I compliment them for going to the polls and voting. It's the most important duty of citizenship to vote. And they went to the polls and voted their conscience, or maybe their conscience and their pocketbooks. But the first thing is, I respect you for going to the polls and vote.
Yeah.
Number two, while I disagree on some things, I disagree very forcefully with what you believe in politics. I am eager to listen to what you have to say, and I'm eager to reach some common ground with you. I recognize that with some supporters of President Trump, I would say maybe 20-25%. They don't want to have any conversation with anybody. They've already had their minds made up. But I refuse to believe that more than 70 million Americans are totally closed-minded.
And we're going to pause right there with legendary CBS News anchor Dan Rather. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We have a very special guest with us. It's veteran news anchor Dan Rather. He became a CBS News correspondent in 1962, covering the major events of our country. Fast forward to today, he has millions of followers on social media, a lifetime reporter. And you can join in the conversation as Dan Rather stays with us for the hour. Let's bring in a call now. Kay is joining us from Maquanago. Hi, Kay. What would you like to ask Dan Rather?
Well, first of all, it's an honor to be able to speak to you, Mr. Rather. I'm an 85-year-old woman. I've followed your career. And I have been watching all the things you've written on social media about unity. And I certainly agree with them that we have to talk to each other. And more than that, we have to listen to each other. And I'm an old woman. I'm not especially religious, but I'm spiritual. And I think that it's very important at a time like this not to give up. And what keeps me going is the virtue of hope. And I think hope is what counts at a time like this, when we feel overwhelmed that we can't do anything, that we just have to pick one little thing and do something and hope that we're helping and know that it might not even come to fruition while we're on this earth. Anyway, those are my comments.
Kay, thank you for that. Dan Rather, Kay, finding faith, hope, and resilience, something you've written about.
What I need, and first of all, Kay, it's good to talk with you, and thank you very much for your compliments about the work. And I'm so glad that you put the question this way. But, you know, what we have to do, and we were talking just before the break about how we talk to people who voted for Trump, we have to find common ground. And we do have more common ground than most people are willing to stop and say, well, yeah, we have common ground. For example, if you're in a community and saying, well, what can I do to fan the flames of hope? Maybe pick one thing, like, does the girls' soccer field need refurbishing? Does the Little League baseball park need work? And try to put together people from the community. And by those, that's common ground. We need a new Little League baseball park, or we need to refurbish it. We need the girls' soccer field, something like that. And just, you know, not built around politics, not built around ideology. Let's just do something for the community. And the next thing you know, you're talking to one another, and then you find other common ground. That's the way we build back together a more united country, in my opinion. Thank you very much, Kay.
Yeah,
faith, hope, and resilience.
Yeah, Kay, thank you. Let's bring in Mark now in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Mark. What would you like to ask?
Hi, Mr. Rather. I'd like to make a comment and ask your opinion. I'm a retired academic, and our recent history has reminded me of something I read years ago by Dear Abby, that we are mostly suburbious coddled kids. We're very naive, and our history has made me think a lot about the evil that can exist and sort of blindside us. In fact, one of my friends said I used to get blindsided because I would always look for the good in people and not see the bad. And I think I had to ask after this election, why would somebody continue to spend money to go to court over and over over the vote knowing they're going to lose? And I started to wonder if it isn't for the purpose of riling up the supporters to make them angrier and angrier and angrier until they would be willing to start a civil war. And I'm concerned that maybe we're looking for a civil war.
Dan Rather, what are your thoughts there?
Well, thank you very much for calling in, Mark, and it's good to talk with you. But frankly, the talk of a civil war, we should think very carefully about even having a conversation on this. Remember, our great civil war in the middle of the 19th century cost us something on the order of 700,000 lives as we fought one another. Frankly, I do not think that we're on the cusp of civil war, but I do take your point that there are people who would like to get enough of people in the country so angry that they do start a civil war. But here's a case where I think all of us need to stop, think for a second, take a deep breath and say to ourselves, you know, let's agree on why we love this great country. Let's agree on those things in which you can find common ground and, you know, and move forward. But I do take your point that, you know, when someone continues to spend a lot of money, such as going to court, trying to overturn an election, it is indeed serious business. And let me just add one thing. Much of this trying to stir up anger about the last election is about gathering money. And it, while it might appear the money was going to go to challenge the election, the fact of the matter is that if you read a small print, the money goes to a political sort of, if you will, slush fund for the outgoing president. So make of that what you will. Thank you, Mark.
We're talking with Dan Rather, longtime journalist, former anchor of the CBS Evening News. He's also the author of the book, What Unites Us? Reflections on Patriotism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You know, Dan, as we're talking there, I'm wondering how you feel about pardons. Should President Trump be pardoned? Should family members be pardoned? Should the president be pardoning himself?
Well, in no particular order, you've asked for my opinion, and I want to make it clear this is my own personal opinion, obviously. But no, I don't think the president should be pardoned. I don't think he should be able to pardon himself. There is some legal question. Most legal scholars believe that, yes, the president perhaps could pardon himself. But should he do it? No. And should he pardon his family members? No. I don't think that this is what the power to pardon was originally intended to be about. But, you know, we're in a situation in which there's so much that has been happening and is happening that's unprecedented in our history. Would I be surprised if the president tried to pardon himself? Would I be surprised if he tries to pardon his family members? No.
We heard from Jane in Suamico, who couldn't stay with us, but called in to ask, do you have any idea about how we can come together around the same understanding of the same facts? Why can't we get on the same page about facts? Jane asks.
Well, one reason that we haven't been able to get on the page about facts is, again, our national leadership has made a sustained effort to convince people that there's such a thing as, quote, alternative facts, alternate facts. We know this isn't true, but the campaign to convince us that, well, there's no real truth, there are no real facts. We know better, but somehow or another, enough of us have become convinced that, well, that's true. But for example, we know 2 and 2 equals 4. It does not equal 5. Water does not run uphill. I mean, there are such things as facts. It amazes me, I confess, that we've reached the point where we even have to talk about whether there are known facts or not. But Jane's question is, how can we come together around the same understanding of the same facts? Well, one of the things I think we can do is begin to teach our young people, beginning no later than the 7th grade, of how to distinguish between facts, what's believed to be true, propaganda. It's a form of if you will, of an advanced civics class in making our young people, as they come up, more informed and more analytical consumers of news. In the here and now, what we can do is remind ourselves that, you know, we're pretty deep down in the hole of political propaganda when it comes to assessing what's true and what's factual. And I think it's as simple as reminding ourselves and reminding everybody, look, let's take the temperature down and let's agree that there is such a thing as a fact, and that sometimes there's opinion, sometimes there's a believed truth, which is not a proven fact, but there are proven facts. It seems a simple thing, but again, I come back to we better start educating our young people
Are you worried? You are so involved in social media. Are you worried about disinformation and foreign interference?
Am I worried? Yes. I'm worried about both. That the amount of disinformation that is on the internet at any given time is truly staggering. Now, some of it is, when I say simple disinformation, I'm trying to distinguish between disinformation that is not outright and designed to be propaganda, but there a great deal of the disinformation, not all of the disinformation, but a great deal of it is just straight up propaganda. And as for foreign interference, it's been well documented, that the internet is a very fertile field for foreign interference in everything from our elections to our business dealings. The internet era has introduced many advantages for people. It's a great place to learn. It can spread knowledge quickly and widely around the world. But part of the dark side is this the spread of disinformation, outright propaganda, and the ability of foreign powers to interfere in the inner workings of our country.
We're spending the hour with veteran journalist Dan Rather. We'll pick this up with him right after this news update on the Ideas Network. What an honor to be in conversation with Dan Rather, award-winning journalist whose work spans more than 60 years. He's covered and witnessed events that profoundly shaped our world. JFK assassination, Vietnam, Watergate, Tiananmen Square, Berlin Wall, 9/11, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now this pandemic, as we've been talking about. And Dan Rather, he stays with us for the hour. Let's take another call now. Jody is with us from Madison. Hi, Jody.
Hi. First of all, I want to say thank you for all your years of service to the Republic. It's an honor to be able to thank you personally. We in Wisconsin are very familiar with movement politics, and I was wondering what there's a lot of movements going on now, the Black Lives Matter, Me Too, and I was wondering what your observations are on this period in U.S. history, and also does it remind you of anything of another time? Also, what your views might be, thoughts of the role of movements in the arc, in moving towards the arc of justice?
Yeah, Jody, great questions in there. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you, Jody. Thanks for calling in. It's good to talk to you. And what a good question. We're, again, this is a situation in which we're about to find out. Now that we've had our election, the election is behind us. We have a new national leadership in former Vice President Joe Biden. That movements, both right and left, are going to begin trying to influence the Biden presidency. Now, keep in mind, as the Biden presidency begins in late January, most observers and most historians don't expect it to be a transformative presidency. They expect it to be a transition presidency. Sometimes those kind of predictions are wrong, but that's the outlook. With that in mind, that movements on what are generally considered to be the political left will begin trying to influence the direction of the Biden presidency. That, as we know from his record, Joe Biden sees himself as a centrist, maybe slightly left of center. That's the way he views himself. But movements on to the left of Joe Biden are going to be working very hard trying to influence his national leadership. On the other hand, movements on the right, and particularly the far right, will be doing everything they can to resist. For example, and let me just take one example, that the Black Lives Matter movement, which was so active as recently as last summer, obviously the leadership made a decision to, I wouldn't say back off, but to pause in hopes of that by taking the focus off of themselves, that Joe Biden, they wouldn't be a burden to Joe Biden. Now, I know there are people with other views. This is my own view of what happened. But now that the election is over, Biden's election, I think the Black Lives Matter movement will again begin to reassert itself more publicly. And that's just one example. Now, there are some similarities between the movement politics of today and those of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. The closest similarity we have would be the 1960s. However, I think it's a mistake to draw too many comparisons between now and the 1960s. Our country is a different country here in 2020, moving to 2021, than it was in the 1960s. For one thing, the demographic makeup of the country is so different. And with the movements in the 1960s, the movement for racial justice of that period and the movement against the Vietnam War, I wouldn't say they're completely different, but there are some major differences between, for example, Black Lives Matter of today. But make no mistake that the movements will be trying to move more toward the arc of justice as they see it in 1920, 21 than they were in late 2020, because the presidential election sort of, if you will, put all the movements on what I would call a slight hold. But we'll see. But do keep an eye on the pressure on Joe Biden to move further to the left. A lot of that pressure is going to come from his own party, and how well he handles that will have a lot to do with the final verdict on the effectiveness of his presidency.
Well, there was also the momentum in the civil rights era of policymaking in concert with social justice efforts. Do you see that policymaking front needing to be activated in order to gain more traction through these movements?
Yes, I do. At the height of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations of this last summer, and roughly before the election campaign began to overwhelm such coverage, there were specific things. For example, defunding the police was one of the goals of some of those who were involved in the movements on the left. Now, there's some considerable evidence that talk of defunding the police hurt Democratic candidates down ballot from Joe Biden and may have hurt Joe Biden itself. But I do think you can expect going forward such things as, look, it's one thing to demonstrate in the streets, but the movement people will be saying, we want specific changes in policy. And a lot of that will begin with wanting those specific changes in policy having to do with rethinking police forces. This is a very difficult subject for Joe Biden to deal with, but beginning with him as he starts his presidency, he's going to have to increasingly answer a lot of those questions of, well, what specific policy changes can be made as a result of the widespread movement such as Black Lives Matter.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Dan Rather, one of the best known names and voices in broadcast journalism, having held the position of anchor for CBS Evening News for more than 20 years. Over the last few years, fast forward now, he's found a new audience on social media, millions of followers on Twitter and Facebook. And we're talking with him about what it is like today in our country. Let's go to Jeremy now in Algoma. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And Mr. Rather, it's a great honor to speak with you this morning. My question is, it kind of goes back to the campaign and the election, but what political gain or damage does the GOP leadership look to see by still continually following this narrative of fraudulent voting, specifically here in Wisconsin, which was an important state in both the last elections? We have our Senator Ron Johnson, who continually is riding that coattail of a fraudulent election. What does that show for future elections, where if certain politicians don't get their way, it's easy just to call for investigations and hold things up in courts?
Jeremy,
well,
thank
first
you.
Of all, it's good to be with you this morning, and what a good question. What this shows for future elections, you know, as I have learned, that when you try to make predictions about the future, you better take a deep breath. That if you live by the crystal ball, you learn to eat a lot of broken glass. And believe you me, I've eaten my share of broken glass over the years. But I do want to talk about what the possibility, maybe the probabilities are for the future. That the reason so many Republican office holders and aspiring office holders are continuing to back what President Trump does and what he stands for is because they think that's the best way for them to hold on to power if they have it and achieve power if they don't have it. Again, they wouldn't remind you, but I remind you that President Trump, despite all that he has done and not done over the last 4 years, received well over 70 million votes. And these Republicans, you know, it's easy, and I, among others, continually say, how can they support so much of what President Trump has done and what he stands for? And the answer is because they think that will, the Republican office holders think it will keep them in office. Part of it is fear. It's a fear that if they break with Trump, they'll be finished in the Republican Party. And if they're finished in the Republican Party, that they're probably finished politically. I'm pausing here because I don't want to overstate it. But this is puzzling, to say the least, why so many Republicans have stuck with him, even through, you know, totally ridiculous things. For example, this is one example, to go to court and in court to say, listen, the election was fraudulent, but not have any evidence, zero evidence, zip, nada, nothing, is, in a word, ridiculous. But you do have so many Republicans, you know, standing behind that and saying, well, I'm not going to say anything against it. And the reason is that they think that among the hardcore Republican voters, that if you go against Trump and Trumpism, even at this late date, that you won't be able to stay in power.
What is rising up there? Is it about power? Is it about fear? Is it about what may happen to your political career?
It's about all of those things. It's about the fear that you will lose power. In that sense, it's about power. And then, you know, each political office holder is hoping to at least hold his political position. Most of them, understandably, want to move up the ladder. So it's about all of those things. But, you know, I will say that I am struck, I'm puzzled, sometimes I'm dumbfounded by the number of Republicans who have remained behind President Trump, even when he's at his worst. And, you know, let's say that President Trump, a lot of people don't want to hear, but President Trump has not been terrible on every subject. But on the really important things, the character and the tone and substance of his leadership have been abysmal.
Well, we need to pause there with legendary journalist Dan Rather. We will be back in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with the elder statesman of American journalism. What an honor to be in the company of Dan Rather this hour, former anchor of the CBS Evening News, in the business for 7 decades and counting, giving us perspective on our world as he sees it this hour. Let's bring in Robert now in Stevens Point. Hi, Robert.
Good morning. Good morning, Kate, Mr. Rather.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Robert.
Yeah, this is something you addressed just a little earlier. I'd like to know what your thoughts are. If we're to speculate, to look into the future, how might we access honest, accurate, truthful reporting of news in the future in light of special interests, parties who own media, and manipulative parties who influence the owners of this media?
Robert,
well,
thank you.
First of all, Robert, it's good to talk with you. Thank you very much for the question. But going forward, your question of how can we access honest, accurate reporting of news in the light of special interest? Well, first of all, it's not going to be easy. It will become increasingly difficult, in my opinion, particularly with the spread of the internet, and who knows what is beyond the internet. I would say that one of the things that would allow you to access honest, accurate reporting of the news is to make a decision on where you're going to get, what are going to be your principal sources of news. We need increasingly better educated and more alert and into analytical thinking of news consumers. For example, that when I absolutely positively need to know and say to myself there are conflicting reports or there's breaking news, and my go-to places, and this is just for me, and I'm giving you an example, you need to choose for yourself and everybody needs to choose for themselves. Have some basic places to go that you, based on your experience, you say, I can count on them. Now, for me, the Associated Press and Reuters. These are two worldwide news gathering operations, as opposed to just news processing operations. They have high ethical standards. They are integrity filled. They really work on accuracy. So those are my two vices. As I say, I try to start with the Associated Press and Reuters. If they confirm a story, I can be pretty sure it's true. If they are running a story, I can be pretty sure that it's suspicious. So you begin by, where are my basic go-to places? You know, perhaps you want to make it NPR as one of your go-to places. But we each of us going forward needs to decide, with all of this propaganda, misinformation coming at us from every direction, you need to have some what I call news base camps. My two are the Associated Press and Reuters. You can choose your own.
Dan, what do you make of the death, if you will, of local news? Dozens of local news outlets have closed in recent months in the pandemic, have folded, although very large outlets like the New York Times have more journalists than ever. What is going on?
Well, what is going on is the not very slow death of local news as we have known it. And I do think that the development, which you emphasize, which is true, that the very large news organizations such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and yes, Fox News, they seem to get larger, whereas local news is dying off very quickly. The deaths of so many local newspapers and even regional newspapers leaves us with a great void of coverage of such things. Just to pick one example, coverage of the local city council or school board meetings where big decisions are made, and the coverage of say state legislatures is practically non-existent in many places, and in other places it's gotten so thin you can see through it. We know that this is very harmful, and it's a trend that's continuing. I don't have the answer to what to do about it, because at base what's happened is the business model that allowed local newspapers and, for that matter, local radio news operations to flourish, the business model has disappeared, and nobody has come up with a new business model. This is a very important development, negative development, which I think a lot of people haven't paid enough attention to, that so many local news organizations have closed during the pandemic. And even before that, there was a trend to do it. And I frankly don't know what to do about it other than to call attention to people that this, when you have local news organizations, they shine a light in those dark corners, such as city council meetings and school board meetings and the state legislature, to hold people accountable. And without that, you're going to see a big increase in corruption at almost every level.
We are in the company of legendary journalist Dan Rather this hour, anchor and managing editor of CBS Evening News for 24 years. We're looking at life in our country through history as well. Mary is with us now from Pewaukee. Hi, Mary. What is your question?
Yes, good morning. Well, first of all, I just wanted to say thank you very much for your important journalism throughout a lifetime. Smart, thought-provoking, and this is my go-to connection for news and facts. But my question then to you, and again, it's a pleasure, Dan Rather, how did you begin your career, and when in your life was it as a child that you knew that this was going to be your lifetime work? And I'll listen off the air.
Thank you very much, Mary. Well, my career really began when I was about 5 or 6 years old. I've never understood exactly why. I think it's because my parents, neither of whom had finished high school during the depths of the Depression in Texas, but because they were avid newspaper readers, somehow or another, I got the idea that I wanted to be a reporter, even before I really knew what a reporter did. So it happened for me very early that what I said to myself when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, according to my mother, I always said, you know, I want to be a reporter. The word journalist was not in widespread use at that time. So the dream began very early in life, and it never varied from it. I knew from a very early age that what I wanted my lifetime work to be, I wasn't sure I could make a living at it. And my big break came when I was working in local news in Houston, Texas, in 1961, when a great hurricane came on the coast. And our coverage, of which I led, of that hurricane was my big break and got me to CBS News. And from then on, I knew, well, I could make at least part of my dream come true. At least I could make a living being a journalist. Before that, it was kind of touch and go.
We are almost out of time, Dan Rather, and I want to get to this question. What would you tell journalists right now who feel so exhausted by covering 2020, so drained? And it seems like you could do it all at once. You could anchor CBS Evening News. You could anchor 48 Hours, 60 Minutes correspondent. What do you say to journalists today?
Well, first of all, Kate, let me tell you what a pleasure it has been and an honor it has been to be with you. You've said some very nice things about my work, and I appreciate it. I appreciate this opportunity. In answer to your question, you know, I would gently and with at least a slight smile tell my journalist friends, don't waver, just suck it up and do the job. Exhaustion is not a word that any journalist worthy of the name entertains for very long, if at all. And, you know, I would also say to them, the country needs you right now, you journalists, particularly the young and up-and-coming journalists, because, you know, a free and independent, truly independent press is the red beating heart of American freedom and democracy. And for journalists, you can't afford to be exhausted. As I say, just take a deep breath, say to yourself, I'm lucky to be where I'm doing, and keep on keeping on.
Dan Rather, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kate, for having me. I've been honored to be on with you. Good luck and Godspeed.
Dan Rather, longtime journalist. His book is What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. It's in paperback, a graphic novel next year. Stay with us for 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.